Because in the beginning, the Bears and the Vikings were supposed to play at noon yesterday, and the game got flexed into Sunday night, and the Bears game coming up in a couple of weeks against the Rams also got flexed into Monday or Sunday night, rather. So the national media is starting to realize that this Bears team is for real. They're a good team. They're now 7-3 on top of it, so they're not a pushover. They're a team that is playoff worthy. They're a team that could win this NFC North division. But last night, in a game in which Mitchell Trubisky proved to me and should have proved to you that he's not the future of this team, the Bears defense took advantage of this Vikings carelessness on offense and won an important game in thrilling fashion. Now let's talk about Trubisky. That's the elephant in the room, if you will. Trubisky, in my opinion, most arguably had the worst game of the season last night. Worst game of the year for Mitchell Trubisky last night. And first of all, I don't care about his 43 rushing yards on 10 attempts. Okay, I don't care about the fact that now Trubisky is the best rushing quarterback in the NFL. He has the most yards, more than Cam Newton even. I don't care about that, okay? Because last night, Trubisky proved to me that despite his ability to scramble and avoid pressure, get out of the pocket, gain some yards, he proved to me that as a passing quarterback, which is what a quarterback is supposed to do, he is not capable of leading a football team to victory. Last night was a very poor showing by Mitchell Trubisky, and it should have showed you the same, that he is not capable of leading a team to a Super Bowl. He had two critical interceptions last night, first of all. And both of those, it seemed as if when he threw it, then he was throwing it directly at the defender. Those were two sloppy passes, even described by Chris Collinsworth, who was broadcasting last night's game with Al Michaels. Collinsworth said that those two passes were sloppy. And he also mentioned that even though Trubisky statistically is good, there are still times where you shake your head and wonder what he was thinking. Last night is a time in which you shook your head and wondered, what was he doing on the field? Those two interceptions were horrendous. He only had one touchdown, and he passed for 165 yards. You know what? You're not going to win many games with a performance like that. I know the Bears won yesterday. I understand that, but they won in spite of Trubisky. And that's the important thing to take away. He did nothing but hurt their chances to win. And that's 100% true. Trubisky did not help the Bears yesterday. If it wasn't for him, the Bears would have won that game easier. It would have been a much different score. Instead, the Vikings were in it until about 46 seconds left in the game. All because of Mitchell Trubisky. And here's what's funny about this. Everyone talking about Trubisky and how great he's done, talking about how he has finally turned a corner with Matt Nagy, talking about how he's not a bust, and that he is the quarterback for this Bears team. Well, how do you like this for an idea? Trubisky, if you get rid of the game against Tampa Bay with the 6 touchdowns and no interceptions, and if you get rid of the game against the Lions last week, he's actually an average quarterback, believe it or not. And statistically, he wouldn't size up the way he is right now. Both of those games were against horrendous defenses. Both of those games were against teams who are not going to make the playoffs. Those were meaningless. Those are games the Bears should have won, and they did, with Trubisky. But last night, in a game that needed to be won from the word go, Trubisky did not lead his team to victory. The Bears won, and I'm going to keep stressing this point, the Bears won in spite of Trubisky. They didn't win because of him. Trubisky didn't step up to the plate last night, and that worries me. That really does worry me, because think about this. If the Bears have to go to the playoffs, let's say they make it, I'm not confident in Trubisky in a one-game, winner-takes-all game. I'm not confident in Trubisky leading the Bears to a big win in the NFC divisional round or the championship game. Because after last night's performance, in a game in which the Bears needed to win, and that's been the first time all year, in my opinion, in which the Bears needed to win a game, in which they had no choice, they had to win, right? And last night, Trubisky knew that, everybody knew that, stepping into the game, and Trubisky laid an egg. He couldn't produce. So, knowing that he had that mindset, knowing that he knew that this game needed to be won and he couldn't produce, worries me come playoff time if the Bears are lucky enough to make it. Now, luckily enough, the Bears' defense bailed them out once again. And I think that's the theme, that's the story of this Bears team this year. Trubisky's not going to always be the answer, right? You're going to need your defense, especially in the Bears' sense, to bail them out. They have the best turnover differential in all of football. They have the most takeaways in all of football. They have the most points off of turnovers in all of football. The Bears' defense is their key to success, not Mitchell Trubisky. And last night, it was proven once again. The Bears won 25-20. They had a touchdown by Eddie Jackson, which was huge, the pick six. Jackson took it all the way from about the 25-yard line. That was huge. If that had not occurred, the Bears might have lost last night's game. Khalil Mack had one sack, one forced fumble, one fumble recovery last night. Mack is averaging one sack per game, which is just mind-boggling to say the least. Akeem Hicks, six tackles, one sack last night. Hicks broke out in a big way. And it's funny because we're sitting here talking about Mack a lot, Roquan Smith, who's emerged himself, that we forgot about Akeem Hicks and how good he's been. Not just this year, but even in the past. He was the anchor for this Bears defense beforehand. The Bears get Mack, they get Roquan Smith, and Hicks is kind of forgot of for a minute. But last night, he proved to me, he proved to everyone that he's still a force to be reckoned with. He still can contribute for this Bears defense. Adrian Amos also had that big interception earlier off of Kirk Cousins. And that's the one thing that I'm happy about. The Bears were able to control Kirk Cousins, one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, whether you like it or not. Cousins is a top 10, top 15 quarterback without a doubt. And the Bears found a way to contain him. They found a way to make sure that, number one, he couldn't complete passes, because that's Cousins' name to the game. He loves to complete passes. He completes like 70% of them. And last night, he went 30 of 46. So, closer to 60, not 70% last night. That took him out of his element. That rattled him as a quarterback. And sure, he had 262 yards, but two interceptions and two touchdowns. Cousins did not do well by any means last night either. And we knew coming in that that was going to be a key to the Bears' success. If the Bears found a way to control Kirk Cousins, and if the Bears found a way to limit the Vikings' run game, Dalvin Cook, you knew they were going to win. And they did. The Vikings last night did nothing. 22 total rushing yards. My goodness. Dalvin Cook had 12, Latavius Murray had 5, and Kirk Cousins had 5. That's it. When you're giving up 22 total rushing yards to guys like Dalvin Cook, Latavius Murray, and Kirk Cousins, you're doing something right. The Bears' defense last night was electric in that regard. And then Cody Parkey, he went from goat to hero. Look at that, huh? I bashed him last week, and rightfully so, because he worried everybody about his ability to make field goals when they matter. The last thing you want is an unsturdy kicking situation going into the playoffs, for example. But Parkey yesterday, he made all three of his kicks, first of all. And secondly, he made a pretty critical one later in the fourth quarter, that 48-yard field goal. It strengthened the Bears' lead. And again, that's another situation where if that didn't go in, we might be talking a different game. We might be talking about the Vikings winning last night had that kick not gone in. And in the same sense, we might be talking about the Vikings today if Eddie Jackson didn't return that touchdown. Both of those guys, Parkey and Jackson specifically, and the Bears defense as a whole, bailed out Mitchell Trubisky and helped this team continue to stay in first place in the NFC North Division. This asserts the team's position amongst the rest of the league. Last night's win asserts to the entire league that the Bears are for real. This isn't a fluke. This isn't like 2012 or 2013 where Josh McCown caught lightning in a bottle or Jake Cutler did himself. No, no, this is legitimate right now. And the funny part is they're doing it without a valid quarterback. They're finding a way to win seven games. They're 7-10 right now, believe it or not, without a running or without a good quarterback. He is a running quarterback, but not a passing quarterback, Trubisky. So I give the Bears credit for lasting this long. And now they've got a task right away. Thursday night game, a short week for the Bears as they face the Lions on Thanksgiving. For the second time in 3 weeks, too. All the Bears have to do is copy their game plan from the week before, right? Trubisky needs to be able to recognize that he's facing a horrendous defense. So in that sense, he has to find a way to replicate his success from before. And the Bears defensively, they have to continue with their ability to stop the run game. Kerryon Johnson is good. LeGarrette Blount is good. The Lions have two bona fide running backs. And the Bears need to come in and assert their dominance over both of them, just like they did last night against Dalvin Cook and Latavius Murray. But anyways, the Bears last night, be satisfied with that victory, of course. Be happy that they're 7-3 as a team. But also, be wary and be worried of the fact that Mitchell Trubisky did not do well. And come playoff time, he's going to need to do well in order for this team to succeed and move on. At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. StopTextStopWrecks.org, brought to you by the National Highway Safety Traffic Administration and the Ad Council. So we just finished up talking about the Bears and their big win last night. If you have any thoughts on that, please give me a call, 773-702-8424. We're going to now shift gears for a minute. We're done talking about the Bears for now and talk about the Golden State Warriors and how this relates, by the way, to Derrick Rose and the Bulls. Some trouble in paradise for the Golden State Warriors. So let's take a walk down memory lane and look back at the NBA over the past 10 years. Here in Chicago, the Bulls sold themselves on a young kid from Chicago in Derrick Rose. And for the first 3 seasons, he took this city and the NBA by storm. There's no question. He won an MVP. He led the Bulls to their first Eastern Conference Finals appearance since the days of Michael Jordan. He won them 112 games over 2 seasons. He was a good player. Later on, however, when the Bulls were looking to add some pieces and improve, Rose took it upon himself to decline all suitors. He said no. He shut down any opportunity for the Bulls to pursue guys like LeBron James, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade. In the end, simply put, his ego got in the way. Derrick Rose was too high on his horse and decided that, you know what, I can lead this team. I'm good enough to do it. In the end, we all know how that worked out. Let's go to Oklahoma City, where at one point, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden coexisted and thrived. Imagine that. 3 superstars on the same team, thriving without a problem. Then after the Harden trade, Durant and Westbrook, they kept butting heads. Their egos had gotten out of hand, and Durant ended up leaving. So we see Rose leave because of ego problems. Durant leaves because of ego problems. Both guys in both situations, both teams, have something in common. Let's fast forward now to today and the 2018-19 Golden State Warriors. And as always, there seems to be some trouble in paradise. Last week, the Warriors were facing the Clippers, and as the final seconds ticked away in the fourth quarter, Draymond Green had the ball, and he actually acted as if he was the point guard. How crazy is that? Draymond Green trying to act like a ball handler. Green took the ball up the court himself, and as Kevin Durant called for the ball repeatedly, many times, Green didn't give it to him. Green then failed to attempt a shot even, sending the game to overtime, and the Warriors ended up losing. Now, after the game, Green and Durant supposedly got into a heated altercation, resulting in a suspension for Draymond Green and a fine. Now, before I describe that incident to you, remember, I talked about egos in the NBA and how they have the potential to ruin relationships and, of course, ruin dynasties. The thing that puzzles me, however, is that Draymond Green thinks he's such an important piece to this Warriors team. He thinks he is irreplaceable. He thinks that his talents are helping to carry the Warriors. He's using his ego as if he's an NBA superstar and that the Warriors would not be able to function without him. Well, Draymond Green, here's a newsflash for you. You're not that good. And that is completely untrue. Draymond Green, in his career, averages 9 points and 7 rebounds per game. That's it. Anybody can do that. For crying out loud, here in Chicago, last year, Bobby Portis averaged 13 points and 7 rebounds per game. Bobby Portis did that. That production level of 9 points and 7 rebounds per game for Green is the equivalent to the production of an NBA journeyman. That's it. He's nothing more than an NBA journeyman. Draymond Green, in my opinion, he's a superstar by association. Look at the team he's been a part of since he's debuted in the league. He's had Stephen Curry by his side. He's had Klay Thompson by his side. When the team won the first championship, Green played a secondary role. He played sidekick to Steph Curry, first of all. Klay Thompson played sidekick to Steph, and Draymond played sidekick to both of them. Draymond did nothing to help that team. Sure, he pulled down some rebounds. He played tough. Sometimes tough to a fault, to where he'd get suspended or fined or do something that was out of the ordinary. He'd get called for technicals and flagrant fouls a lot. So he was too physical to a fault. He grabbed some rebounds, but most importantly, he played second fiddle to Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. Once Kevin Durant came around, Draymond Green's role was even more diminished. What else could he do? The points that he was getting were now being siphoned away by Kevin Durant. Draymond never scored before, and if you thought he'd score now, he wouldn't. Durant's on the team. So Green's role continually gets diminished and diminished until there's almost nothing left. Case in point, this year, he's only averaging 7 points, 7 rebounds, and 7 assists. And although the rebounds and assists are fine, that point total, the lowest it's ever been. Lowest it's ever been for Draymond Green. Draymond is known because of his fiery personality and because of the fact that he's on the Warriors. He's on America's team now. The Warriors are America's team of basketball. The Cowboys are America's team of football. And right now, you can make the argument that the Chicago Cubs are America's team of baseball. All of those teams are teams in which everyone knows the players, thereby making them superstars, quote-unquote. But that doesn't mean that the player's production is necessarily good. Dak Prescott, for example, with the Cowboys, he's not doing well right now. He's not doing well in general. But you know what? Everyone knows his name, and he's being talked about extremely a lot. It seems like every day I turn on a national media outlet, and there he is. They're talking about Prescott and how bad he's doing. Why? He's on America's team. Everybody cares whether he does bad or good. And the best part is, the national media tries to spin it into Prescott doing well. Draymond Green, in the past, everyone considered him a superstar. He was being elected to all-star teams, for crying out loud. He's a three-time all-star. Draymond Green is a three-time all-star, and he averages 9 points per game throughout his career. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Come on now. It's all superstar by association. Draymond Green is teammates with Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Kevin Durant. He has three rings to his name, and he's on the Golden State Warriors. That's exactly the reason why everyone knows who Draymond Green is. That's the reason why everyone knows who Green is, and no one knows who Bobby Portis is. Same difference, because they produce at the same level, but one's on the Warriors and one's on the Bulls. That's it. So Draymond Green is not a superstar. He thinks he is, but he's not. He's not a good player. He's an average NBA journeyman. Draymond Green averaging 9 points a game means that he's not a superstar, he's not a glue to this team, and that sure as hell does not mean that his presence necessarily leads to more success for Golden State. If Draymond was not there, you tell me if that team still would have won their three NBA championships. My bet is that they still would have. You could find anybody to rebound the basketball. And Draymond adds a toughness component, something that cannot be replicated. But again, it's added to a fault. Draymond is too physical. Draymond gets called for flagrants, technical fouls. He gets suspended all the time. That's not what you want in a player. Draymond Green, for all statistical purposes, is merely a blip on the radar. I don't understand myself why he has such a big ego and why he thinks he's that important to this team. Draymond Green means nothing to these guys. Draymond Green should be happy that he's there and that he gets to witness greatness day in and day out. He should be happy that he's been able to see Steph Curry break the three-point record in 1 year and win two MVPs. He should be happy that Klay Thompson has the most threes in one game and the most points in one quarter. And he should be happy that he gets to watch Kevin Durant play, a top five player, even a top three player in the NBA behind LeBron James. He should be happy. He should feel that he is privileged enough to get to see that stuff. What he shouldn't be doing is what he's doing right now, which is cause a big stink with the team, pretend that he is important, and pretend that he makes a difference in the wins and losses of this team. He needs to realize that it's not him. He has no say. He has no influence in this team's success. So Draymond, take it from me, if you're listening right now. You're not that good. You're not that important. You don't mean crap to this Warriors team. So if I were you, I'd pick yourself up, apologize to your teammates, apologize to your coaches, and get back out there and play your game. Stop causing a big stink. Stop causing problems for your team. And realize that you should be happy where you are. You could be on an entirely worse team. You could be Bobby Portis on the Bulls. You could be anybody on the Bulls or any other team in the NBA. Because the truth is that between the Rockets, the Warriors, maybe the Raptors and Celtics, there isn't another team that's going to contend for a championship. There are a select amount of teams that you could say, yes, I can see them winning the finals right now. Draymond's on one of them. He's been on one of them. Be happy that you're a part of that. Instead of causing problems with superstars like Durant and Curry and Thompson, why don't you realize your role, realize what you do for this team, and understand that you mean nothing. Understand that you are just a rotational type player, and that on any other team, it wouldn't work out. You're a franchise player. You fit in the Golden State Warriors system. And that's it. And by fitting in the system, that means maybe you'll average 10, 12 points a game. If Draymond Green was on another team right now, I guarantee you his numbers would be worse. They'd be worse. He wouldn't be able to handle it. He wouldn't be able to handle being the guy. That's why he's on the Warriors. That's why he plays fourth fiddle to Thompson, Curry, and Durant. Draymond, realize your role on this team. And realize that just because you're on a team filled with superstars, that doesn't mean that you yourself are a superstar. Draymond Green, in essence, is just an average basketball player. And his presence never has and never will mean anything to this Golden State Warriors team. The National Foundation for Infectious Diseases reminds you that vaccination is not just for kids. More U.S. adults die of vaccine-preventable diseases than from breast cancer, AIDS, or traffic accidents. Talk with your doctor and visit www.adultvaccination.org. So we just finished up talking about the Warriors. We talked about the Bears earlier too. Any thoughts on both subjects or thoughts on the MLB, which we'll be getting to soon? Give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, 773-702-8424. So right now, it's time for the Sports Talk Chicago Flashback, as each week we'll play a newsworthy clip from one of my podcasts. I had the great opportunity recently to talk with Greg Gumbel, NFL and NCAA broadcaster for CBS. In these next few minutes, you'll hear about his rise to success, which all started right here in Chicago. How interesting is that? He started here with WMAQ Channel 5. We also touch on his best advice for young broadcasters, and I also got to ask him about his depiction in Family Guy with his brother Bryant Gumbel. He's an all-around great guy. It was a really fun interview to do with Greg, and I'm so happy that I get a chance to play this for you right now on the air. After this, we'll talk to Jerry Krasnick, formerly of ESPN.com, talk about the MLB awards, what he thought, and his votes in the awards decision as well. But right now, here's my candid conversation with Greg Gumbel. You're listening to WHBK 88.5 FM, Chicago. Talk about your amazing career in broadcast journalism. I'd love to hear about your story, how you ended up rising to the top. I know it did involve your brother. It's pretty interesting. If you don't mind, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, he's a nosy busybody, as everybody who knows him knows. I was actually selling, Bryant's been in the business about 4 years longer than I have, and I was selling hospital supplies in the city of Detroit, and he called me one day in 1973, and he asked me if he told me that there was a weekend sportscasting position open at the NBC affiliate in Chicago, and if I were interested. And so I flew in and I auditioned with a bunch of other people, and they said, "Don't call us, we'll call you." And 3 weeks later, they called. So that's how I got started. And I spent 7.5 years at MAQ there, and then 5.5 at ESPN, 3 years at Madison Square Garden, and then went to CBS, and then NBC, and then back to CBS after that.
Wow, that's extremely impressive. And your accolades, too, they're simply incredible. I mean, you've won multiple Emmy Awards for your broadcasting skills. You've called two Super Bowls on TV for CBS. So what do you attribute your success to? And do you have any advice for younger broadcasters today trying to break into the business?
Well, first of all, the options for young broadcast wannabes are numerous, and they weren't numerous back then when I was starting. You know, right now, everybody has a need for sportscasting because there are, what, 80,000 TV channels? every one of them want to present sports in some way, shape, or form on whatever platforms. So I was fortunate, and Bryant and I have never denied the fact that we were very fortunate, you know, to be in such a competitive business. And I started in Chicago and he started in Los Angeles. You know, there are people who are very talented who never, for whatever reasons, find their way out of Keokuk, Iowa, or Battle Creek, Michigan, or Yuma, Arizona. So we were very fortunate to do that. The other thing that I firmly believe is that Channel 5 in Chicago was looking for someone of color. And while people may decry that, I don't, because I was the lucky recipient of it. Now, it doesn't mean that just because you're black and they're looking for someone black that they'll keep you. If they're looking for someone black and you can't do the job, they'll find someone else who's black. So that's no guarantee, but it did give me the opportunity. I think I was hired at ESPN for that same reason. Now, after that, I happen to think it was because, for whatever reason, people along the way have liked and enjoyed what I do. And in that, I'm very fortunate, especially because I never, ever took a communications course in school. Neither did Bryant. Bryant was a Russian history major. I was an English major. And the options that happened in broadcasting happened to come our way, and we happened to be able to capitalize on them. And I think it's really as simple as that. As for people who are looking to get into the business, I would just keep knocking on doors if I were them. Keep talking into tape recorders. Keep listening to yourself. I found the worst thing in the world. I still find it difficult to listen to myself, because I hate the sound of my voice. But I think that if you do it, then you kind of hear what you say wrong. You kind of recognize if you have words that you lean on as a crutch, and you avoid those. And I think that you force yourself to make yourself better.
And on a final note, I wanted to ask you about your depiction in Family Guy as a crime-fighting duo with your brother Bryant. Personally, I thought it was quite funny seeing you two in that role. How did that come about, and what were your thoughts on it?
We didn't have any clue. They just did it. and I've been a fan of the show for a long time, and having watched the show for a long time, Bryant and I agree, they could have been a lot better. Tougher on. It could have been a lot meaner. It could have been very embarrassing. I thought they treated us very nicely and very well, and I was thrilled to have been a part of it, to be honest with you. I still watch the show regularly. I think it's one of the funniest shows on television, but yeah, every once in a while someone will come across and say, "Didn't you do it?" Yeah, was that your family? Was that your voice? No, we didn't do any voiceovers. We were just depicted, and you know, the way you see some others depicted, we came off very, very well.
So there was my interview there with Greg Gumbel. Really fun talking with him. Thought it was funny, too, you know, the Family Guy reference. He was depicted in Family Guy with his brother, Bryant, as a crime-fighting duo. And he mentioned that, you know, as he said in that interview, could have been a lot worse. But anyways, he's a pros pro. He called the game yesterday for CBS. He's usually on the team with Trent Green and Bruce Arians, the former coach. So always an informative voice, always a pros pro, a professional in this business for quite a while, and so nice of him to take the time and come on the podcast. So we're waiting for Jerry Krasnick to call right now, but until then, let's play actually our announcer's call of the day segment. Time for our signature segment here on Sports Talk Chicago. So last week, Joe Mauer, former AL MVP and All-Star catcher, announced his retirement from baseball. Mauer was the face of the Minnesota Twins for over a decade, and at one point was one of the best catchers in the game. Despite all of those accolades, though, it took Joe Mauer 13 years before he recorded his first walk-off home run. Let's listen in to Dick Bremer on the call for Fox Sports North as Joe Mauer steps up to the plate with two outs in the bottom of the ninth inning.
High drive, left center field. Going back is Bradley. It's gone! A walk-off home run for Joe Mauer.
How about that?
Great call there by Dick Bremer. Joe Mauer hitting his first walk-off home run, and Mauer recently retired. We wish him all the best. But this does bring up an interesting conversation, and it's something that I got a lot of heat for online and on social media when I made this comment. And that's the fact that, in my opinion, Joe Mauer is not a Hall of Fame player. In fact, he's not even close. And say what you want. You can give me a call and debate me if you want. 773-702-8424. But I don't agree with that. Joe Mauer, if anything, is a borderline Hall of Famer. He is not a slam dunk case by any means. There are better players who have fallen off the ballot before Joe Mauer should be considered. Kenny Lofton, a great example. Kenny Lofton was on the ballot for only 1 year. He didn't even get 5% of the vote, fell off the ballot completely, okay? But Lofton, in his career, hit .299, had 2,400 hits, had 622 stolen bases, and had a WAR at 68.3. That's Hall of Fame worthy. Tim Raines just got in. Kenny Lofton, in my opinion, is a slightly better player. And if not, they're evenly matched, to say the least. Yet you're telling me that Lofton deserves to get kicked off the ballot after 1 year and Raines sticks on it for 10 and makes it in? That's not the way it works. Not at all. I mean, Lofton had 5 years in which he led all of baseball in stolen bases. The guy won multiple gold gloves, finished top five in the MVP voting before. Kenny Lofton is a Hall of Famer. Just like Tim Raines is right now as well. So just comparing Lofton to Mauer. Right now you look at Joe Mauer and everyone's saying, oh yeah, he's a slam dunk. No doubt in my mind, Joe Mauer is a Hall of Fame player. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Joe Mauer in his career has 2,100 hits, a .306 batting average, and an .827 OPS. That's not great. At least offensively speaking. That's not amazing. That's not something to where I go and go like, wow, he is 100% a Hall of Famer without a doubt. That's not what I think of when I hear the name Joe Mauer at all. But yet everyone in the media, everyone on social media is making the case saying that Mauer, without a doubt, he's not just a Hall of Famer. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. That's unbelievable. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Look, Mauer had a time in which he was very good. He had his MVP year was great, actually. I mean, 28 homers, 96 RBIs, a .365 batting average. Yes, at that point, yes, he was one of the best players in the game. But here's my problem with that logic. And everyone makes that logic, too, for Chase Utley. And I've had many a debate with people about Chase Utley as well, being in the Hall of Fame. I disagree with that as well. Just because you're on top of baseball for two or three seasons doesn't mean that you deserve to be a Hall of Famer. By that logic, let's put Josh Hamilton in the Hall of Fame. I mean, come on now. Are we just going to let anybody in? Joe Mauer was good for 4 or 5 years. And even then, here's a great stat, he's never played 150 games in a season. The most he's played is 146. And even better than that, as a catcher, he's only played a limited amount of games. These past 4 or 5 years, he hasn't even gone near the pads. He's been a first baseman. So what are you going to elect him as? How are you going to equate his stats and make them split between first base and catcher? You're not going to. That's irrelevant, in my opinion. That's inapplicable. There's no point in sitting there and doing that. Mike Piazza, there's a Hall of Famer. Offensively, he has the most home runs by a catcher ever. That's a Hall of Fame player. But Joe Mauer? No, he's not. Not even close. And anyone who says he is, you're completely wrong. You're completely wrong. No doubt about it. Joe Mauer offensively actually equates to Don Mattingly. Mattingly's not in the Hall of Fame. And defensively, I don't know who he equates to because he hasn't played catcher in a while. Joe Mauer couldn't take being a catcher. Therefore, he stopped playing it. So again, defensively speaking, what are you going to elect him as? Is it going to be a catcher? Is it going to be a first baseman? I don't know. I have no clue how that's going to be determined. Now, granted, there are 5 years left before he gets on the ballot. There's a lot of time to look at his career, look at his case, outweigh the goods and bads, I guess. But I'll be the first to say it right now. Joe Mauer's not a Hall of Famer. He's not even close. And that's another guy, too. Mauer is one. And another guy who I want to talk about for a minute here is Roy Halladay. I don't care what anyone says. Roy Halladay is not a Hall of Fame player. Sure, he was good. His WAR is 64.3. He has 203 career wins. But that doesn't mean he's a Hall of Famer. Heck, you know what? If you want to elect Roy Halladay, fine. That means Mark Burley gets in too. You want to sit there and play that game of which is which and sit there and make the argument that one is better than the other? Well then, you know what? Mark Burley gets in too, because Burley has the same amount of wins. He has more innings pitched. He has a similar strikeout rate, because Halladay, you know, everyone forgets that Halladay did not strike guys out. He has 2,100 strikeouts to his name. That's nothing. John Lester has more, and Lester's not a Hall of Famer. So think about that for a minute. Sure, again, Halladay had a couple of good years. He was a two-time Cy Young winner. There are a lot of guys who won the Cy Young who aren't in the Hall of Fame. Hate to break it to you, but that's just true. That's 100% fact. There are multiple players. Oral Hershiser. You know, a lot of players. Bartolo Colon, he's not a Hall of Famer. I'm sorry. No matter how much you like him, social media or, you know, baseball fans, Bartolo Colon is nowhere near being a Hall of Famer. So using the Cy Young argument for Roy Halladay, that doesn't convince me. Okay? Halladay has 67 complete games. That's a lot, actually. That's great, right? But 203 wins is not a lot. 2,100 strikeouts is not a lot. Less than 3,000 innings is not enough. That's it. So those who say that Halladay, that Mauer, are not only Hall of Famers, but are first ballot Hall of Famers, that is just so ridiculous, so mind-boggling, that I am having trouble wrapping my head around that idea. The Baseball Hall of Fame is an exclusive club, okay? Now, are there guys who I feel should be in who aren't? Yes. Mike Mussina should be in the Hall of Fame. He has 270 wins, he has 2,800 strikeouts, and 3,000 innings pitched. All of those numbers are inherently better than Roy Halladay. Yet we're sitting here talking about how Halladay is a first ballot, no doubt Hall of Famer, and Mike Mussina is still struggling to get 75% of the vote. Explain to me how that works. How does that equate? That makes no sense to me. Or a guy like Kenny Lofton, 2,400 hits, 600-plus stolen bases, 300 batting average, one of the best defensive center fielders of all time. He gets off the ballot in one try, and Joe Mauer now is being talked of as a first ballot, no doubt, Hall of Famer. The process to elect players is unfair completely. Without a doubt, it's completely unfair. And I agree with that sentiment, rightfully, whatsoever. But don't sit here now and turn around and claim that guys who aren't Hall of Famers should be. Roy Halladay is not a Hall of Fame player. And Joe Mauer, just because he recently retired, that does not mean that he is a Hall of Fame player. Hey guys, make sure to check out the WHPK 88.5 FM electronic format launch party featuring Igloo Ghost and WHPK DJs Sasha No Disco, DJ Purple, and Jared Brown. It's at the Cope Prosperity Sphere at 3219 South Morgan Street at 8 p.m. on Thursday, December 6th, $10 cover charge. Should be a very fun venue. I'm planning on going myself. So make sure to check that out again, December 6th, 8 p.m. at the Cope Prosperity Sphere, 3219 South Morgan Street, as WHBK presents Igloo Ghost and WHBK DJs Sasha No Disco, DJ Purple, and Jared Brown. It's the electronic format launch party. So I went off on a bit of a tangent, went off on a bit of a rant, and talked about some Hall of Fame players, guys who are being considered for the Hall of Fame that shouldn't be. Earlier, we talked about the Golden State Warriors and their dysfunction as a team. And we also talked about the Bears and their big win last night, but how that proves that Mitchell Trubisky is not the reason why they won, and how Trubisky had nothing to do with last night's win. Interesting, huh? If you have anything to contribute to the conversation, give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. We've got about 13 minutes left here in the program. And today we're going to be talking about now, sticking with MLB, talking about the MLB awards from last week. Talk about the idea that I don't agree with all of the guys that were selected. I actually highly disagree with some of them. But if you're keeping score at home, once again, I went 6-for-6 in my picks, which was nice. Last year, I went 6-for-6 as well. But remember, just because my predictions were correct doesn't necessarily mean that I agree. I don't agree with that. There are a lot of awards decisions that right now I'm still scratching my head about. I don't understand how the voters came to that conclusion. And ironically enough, these are the same people who vote for the Hall of Fame, so I'm not at all surprised that they got some things wrong. Now, let me talk about what does make sense first. Christian Yelich makes sense. He deserved to win the NL MVP. As a Cubs fan, it was saddening to not see Baez win, but I get it. Baez didn't have the best year in the NL. I'm not going to give an MVP award to a guy who has an on-base percentage under .330. I mean, come on. You can't do that. Yelich had a 1,000 OPS. He actually led the NL in WAR, batting average, slugging percentage, OPS, total bases. Yelich is the better player. Without a doubt, without question, he deserves the award, and he got it. In the American League, the Cy Young Award also a no-brainer in my opinion. Blake Snell was the best pitcher in the AL last year. He led the league in WAR for pitchers, in wins, ERA, ERA+. I know that he didn't pitch many innings, but when he did, he was the dominant pitcher. He was the AL's best pitcher. That's without question. I have no problem with that. Now we get to the gray area. These are the players who, they won their respective awards, yet in my opinion, they don't truly deserve it. And that starts with AL Rookie of the Year. I don't care about the fact that Shohei Ohtani pitched and hit at a good level, because he wasn't great in both cases by any means. Ohtani hit .285 and he had 21 home runs. Congratulations! Good job! Who cares? What'd your team do? Nothing! Your team did absolutely nothing. And who cares that you posted a 3-3 ERA in 50 innings? Anyone can do that. Lou Trevino of the A's won 8 games out of the bullpen, pitched to an ERA under 2 as a rookie, and he wasn't even considered. But Shohei Ohtani is for his pitching ability? That doesn't work. That doesn't equate. That doesn't make sense. Now he's going to need Tommy John surgery on top of it. So now that makes sense too. You know, he didn't play much. Got a text here from a listener in regards to my rant about Joe Mauer. He, quote, he probably had as good of a peak catcher-wise as anyone else in history, but concussions really hurt him. He should definitely get in before Yadier Molina. Okay. I get what you're saying. I don't agree with it. Look, I hate the idea of peak. I don't like that. Because you have a good peak, that doesn't mean that you're all of a sudden a Hall of Famer. If I'm my best for 1 year, does that make me a Hall of Famer? I use the Josh Hamilton example. If I win AL MVP and hit 300 for 3 years, does that make me a Hall of Famer? Now Josh Hamilton, he's out of baseball. He suffered a relapse in regards to drug addiction, and he can't get his life back together. So what are you supposed to do to that? He can't do much. Josh Hamilton is not a good player. Josh Hamilton is not a Hall of Famer. That means Joe Mauer isn't either. Hello? Oh, yes, we can get you on right now. Hold on 1 second. So right now we've got Jerry Krasnick on the line. So we're going to get him on the air. Let me give you a bit of an intro on him. So Jerry Krasnick on the phone now. He began his sports media career covering for the Biddeford Journal-Tribune. And in 1988, he served as the Cincinnati Reds beat writer for the Cincinnati Post, covering the 1990 World Series championship and Pete Rose's suspension for Major League Baseball. Today, following a lengthy tenure as an MLB writer for ESPN, he's a contributor to Baseball America and a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Please welcome Jerry Krasnick to the show. Jerry, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
I'm doing well, John. How are you?
Doing great. So happy that you're here today. And to start, let's take a look back at the MLB Awards Week. Now, I know that there was some consensus selections, including Jacob deGrom as Cy Young and Mookie Betts as MVP, but there were also some surprises. What's your impression on last week's awards as a whole?
Well, I thought there were some interesting choices. Obviously, Shohei Ohtani provided a little bit more of a different look. We hadn't seen anybody like him, so I think you had to factor in his two-way contribution. There could certainly be a little bit of argument with Alex Cora and how well he did in Boston, managing the Red Sox to 108 victories in a World Series, but the call was made before the postseason, and Bob Melvin certainly did a great job with the Oakland A's. I think, as far as the MVPs, with Yelich and Betts winning, I think that was probably what people expected. Jacob deGrom obviously getting 29 of 30 votes with a 10-9 record shows that people don't value wins as much as they used to. Certainly the electorate's mindset has evolved. So, I think most of the awards probably played out to expectations. You certainly wondered maybe if Blake Snell, having about 35 fewer innings than Justin Verlander, would win the Cy Young, but it's pretty hard to argue with a sub-2 ERA. So I think in general the Reds did a pretty good job.
You mentioned Jacob deGrom, and I know that, his 10-9 record, the voters, as you mentioned, evolved. They understand now that wins don't mean much. Now, you had a vote in that, and you also picked deGrom to win. Were you at all worried about deGrom's win total? Take me through the idea behind your vote picking deGrom as your first ballot choice.
Yeah, that's a good point. I did have a vote, and, probably up until maybe 3 weeks or so before, I was, leaning towards Scherzer, but I just thought that DeGrom's record of excellence, and look, I have sort of evolved with other voters, and I think, I'll include wins as a factor, but it's pretty far down the list. I mean, I don't get that deep into the metrics, but I do look at things like whip and, ballpark that they pitch in and strikeouts to innings and, strikeouts to walks and that sort of thing. And I just thought that DeGrom, from start to finish was the best pitcher in the National League. That being said, I know there was one voter, from San Diego who voted for, Max Scherzer, and I didn't think it was that bad a choice. You know, he did strike out 300 guys, and he was pretty amazing. I just think that, you know, 18 wins compared to 10, the way we look at it now, I mean, it's largely a function, obviously, of run support and, you know, bullpen and that sort of thing. And I just think it was unfair to punish DeGrom for having only 10 wins when his support was just so pathetic. And, you know, it's he certainly could have easily won 20 games, but, you know, with the evolution of more complicated statistics, we just don't look at wins in the same light anymore.
Jerry Krasnick here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Jerry, let's move to the free agent market now and this offseason. I wanted to get your initial thoughts on Bryce Harper and Manny Machado. Now, are you expecting them to get the $350 to $400 million contract that they're, you know, wanting to get? And which teams do you think are willing to pay that price?
Well, you know, I think they're certainly going to go north of 300. You know, you just look at their age, being around 26 years old. You know, I've seen estimates of 13 and 14 year contracts. I just don't see that happening, but it's pretty hard not to think that they're going to get 10 years anyway. And, you know, if they get 10 years, we're going to be talking well in excess of 300. You know, whether they get to 400, I don't know. I think Scott Boras probably easily thinks 400 for Bryce Harper and might be thinking closer to 500. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I think some of the usual suspects probably aren't in play. You know, the Yankees certainly would be a great fit for those guys, but they need starting pitching more. I don't see Boston as a fit. You know, I'm in Philadelphia, so I think Philadelphia is certainly going to be at the forefront of a lot of the discussion just because they're a young team that's moving up in the world. Their payroll is pretty low, and John Middleton, the owner, is a very aggressive guy, and he definitely wants to make a splash. So the Phillies are going to be at the center of the discussions for both guys, I would assume. You know, beyond that, we'll have to see. You have the Cardinals, you have the Cubs, you know, but the Cubs seem to be maybe tightening the belt a little bit. You have the Dodgers. There's only so many teams that can handle that kind of a commitment. It's not a particularly long list.
What are your thoughts on the White Sox making a run for either of those two guys? I mean, they have the payroll space. They've got a good farm system. You know, they're close to opening up their window and being ready to win. Do you feel like they can make a run at either of these two guys as well?
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting team that we've heard in there. I think they're still probably a couple of years away, but those guys are young enough that they could fit, and it would certainly give some nice cover for Moncada and, you know, a lot of these young guys they have coming up. So every year you see sort of this interloper that you don't expect, and maybe they're the dark horse team, you know, that we see. Certainly, I think given, as I mentioned, how some of these other teams have maxed out and gone over the payroll threshold, there are going to have to be a couple of teams that jump in that aren't particularly expected, whether it's the White Sox or the Padres or whoever it is. You know, so they're not normally a team you would think front of mind for those kinds of guys, but they are in a position where they probably have the payroll flexibility, and certainly, you know, those guys are young enough that when those teams are ready to compete, the White Sox, for instance, in a year or two, when they get to that place they want to be, a guy like Harper or Machado would still be in their prime.
Now, I wanted to move to your personal career, talk about your great journalism career. How did you end up getting involved in sports journalism, and how much has it meant to you to have this job and cover baseball for a living?
Well, I got into it. I was a Boston University grad, and I got out in 1980, and I went to school at an interesting time. You know, I got to see Carl Yastrzemski's 3,000th hit at the Fenway Park stands, and I was there for the Bucky Dent game and John Havlicek's final game. I got to see some pretty cool things when access to tickets was a little more available, and didn't necessarily know that I was going to get into sports writing, but I did back in my native Maine. And then in 1988, I got a call and went to work at the Cincinnati Post covering the Reds. So Didn't really envision spending 30 years covering baseball, but obviously felt very fortunate. You know, it was one of those things where you do feel like you never really worked a day because you wake up in the morning, you enjoy what you do so much, and you really have to keep reminding yourself of that. But I've seen an awful lot of amazing things, you know, on the field and in Cincinnati and some other places off the field, and certainly consider myself very fortunate.
Well, Jerry, I'm sorry, that's all the time we have for today, but